First case in our calendar is 97-2200, Martin Hillier versus Global Market Insurance Company. Mr. Bass. You didn't file the appropriate request to do that, and that's not fair to opposing counsel, so you've been told that, so you'll have to take the entire argument.
Why do you need that much time? Isn't this case decided by Ross?
Basically, Your Honor, it's my feeling that this case was decided by Ross, and the issue is straight out of the opinion.
The fact is that Ross is uninsured motorist coverage, and this is liability. Is that any difference, or is the contract principle the same?
Your Honor, the total decision is strictly a contract case. And the contract, although the plaintiff is not party to that contract, the contract determines the rights between Great American and the United States. And that just as in Ross, the court held that the
some of that language you quote in your brief is right out of law. So the proposition is from there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The warning right after buying the opinion is based upon the court, and it should be clear. The scope of coverage and our legal liability policy is to find those statutory law effective at the time of contracting. That warning right out of the language of the policy itself. Even though the syllabus addresses U.S. coverage, that statement right out of the language of the FTA doesn't refer to uninsured revenue. It stands alone in my view.
This court has made a point, though, over time to make sure that we distinguish as among uninsured, underinsured, and liability coverage, haven't we? Yet this is being pursued by the victim of the tort, the insurance, right? Not by the policyholder.
Right. But we have an interest in this determination of the policy. Like I said, again, you're not party to this policy, but we have an interest in how it's determined on the truth.
I can foresee that. Tell me what you say that interest is.
Is in recovering for the tortious conduct. But the tortious conduct is only the triggering event that brings into play all of the rights and responsibilities that are then spelled out in the contract. So you do have to have the tortious conduct to invoke the liability, which I agree with you there. But after that tortious conduct brings about, if you will, invoke the policy.
On what date? What date? The date of the accident. In a certain way, they get a certain policy for a certain amount of coverage. That's bargaining for. That's what
the insurance company issuing the policy based on premiums on. All of these things are being taken into consideration, being taken into consideration by policy.
Right.
It's the same thing from the U.S.
Should we also take into consideration the potential harm that might be wrought by such a decision in terms of victims in accidents who may wish to take advantage of the statutory law at the time of the accident? Could there ever be a situation, you know, we're weighing here, couldn't there just as likely be a situation differing from the one here, where obviously the higher limits apply? But couldn't we also envision a situation where a victim of a tort is harmed by the rule of law that applies the contract as between the insurer and its insured, when the victim of the accident could have taken advantage and wished to take advantage of some change in the law in the interim?
I think that there could be turned around in the most interesting situation. There could be things where we may have to consider what the higher principle. The legislature has public policy, so it tends to make a decision as to what the policy is stated. And if a statute changes the right under public policy, that's one thing. I think, however, for a statute to impair contractual obligations already existing, that is the Constitution. And I think that the higher harm might be to, in this case, interfere with parties' contractual rights as opposed to what the legislature may announce in public policy.
You indicated you wanted amicus to argue. Is that the 2-year contract issue?
Exactly.
How does that figure into this?
Well, the authority is going to argue in this case that the policy was renewed on October 21st, 1994. It's curious to note in their policy that they submitted in the record that all of the classifications in the policy was issued February 1995. So unless that is some kind of backdating to October 21st, I'm not sure exactly how that is in February 1995. But the approach to this is that the policy in Ohio under 393730 is issued for a guaranteed policy period of 2 years. That the statute also says may be renewable for a guaranteed period of 2 years. But our position would be that those interim renewal periods are not actually complete renewals of the policy. So that once the policy is issued for that 2-year period, the coverage must in fact remain constant and continuous during the whole life of the policy period. That being the case, the fact that this accident happened on November 6th of 94 is within the 2-year window of guaranteed policy period, which was amended until 95.
Okay, now practically we know that the insurance carriers in this state don't issue those contracts for any longer than a period of 6 months, do they? What about your own policy? Isn't it 6 months? Mine is.
I have to pay my premium, if I recall correctly, I think every 6 months.
Okay. I understand that. Let's just start with that. I've read the Learned Law Review article of your colleague arguing the 2-year issue. Is your argument that even though you pay premiums for 6 months, the policy term is 6 months, that there is no way that the carrier could cancel you until another year and a half has gone by?
No, Your Honor. I believe they can cancel you, but if they choose to do that within the 2-year period, they have to comply with the cancellation provisions contained in the statute. In other words, I think the benefit of interpreting the statute that way occurs to people who are insured under policies. I'm sure you're aware that the general public in the state of Ohio generally doesn't know what their coverages are most of the time.
Yeah, well, let's not get into that. Let's just stick with the policy because this is an important issue. You're saying that the 6 months, they can cancel after 6 months if they follow the statute. Now, what do they have to do under the statute to cancel?
The cancellation. And if no one cancels you during the guaranteed period or a number of different things,
Okay. Now, if in fact they can cancel, doesn't that negate the 2-year argument?
Sure.
For instance, I've got a 3-year lease on a commercial building with a 30-day cancellation clause. Do I have a 3-year lease? I used to go through this in the practice all the time. People say, oh, yeah, I got the 3-year lease. And then you turn to clause 17 that says it can be canceled by either party on 30 days' notice or by the landlord. What do you have? You have a 3-year lease or you have a 30-day lease?
In my opinion, you have a 3-year lease subject to cancellation under certain conditions. But they still have to give you notice of that. And they can make you aware that they're canceling the policy and reissuing
it. Yeah, and that's the distinction here. They didn't do that. This clearly was renewed under the same terms and conditions.
Right. And I think the statute itself actually draws a distinction between renewal and cancellation. In the first part of the statute, it refers to guaranteed renewal for the term of 2 years. And then later on in the statute, it refers to cancellation. Well, the only if the renewal is not cancellation, then the cancellation language in the statute comes to apply to a 2-year period. In other words, after 2 years, this policy cancels automatically. And they can rewrite you another policy. Again, we would argue for another 2-year guarantee period. But if they are going to do any major change to the policy, again, going back to the interference of contract, any change between the agreed upon terms of the parties, they have to properly cancel that contract from an issue.
Okay, just to sum this up then on that issue. What is the date of the original policy?
October of 1993. I believe it's the 21st.
Well, there's some argument about what day it is, I think, there. But October 21, I think, is acceptable. 1993, right? Okay. When was the policy renewed?
According to them, it was renewed on October.
Okay. A year later.
Yes.
What was the date of the accident?
November 6th, 1994.
After the renewal date.
Yes.
What was the date of Senate Bill 20?
October 20th, 1994.
Therefore.
But now I can't play the policy. Not cancellation, but it was ready to play the statutory change.
So the renewal on October 21, 1994, you have to contend, was nothing more than the extension of the original policy from
93.
So we don't have to care either. If you take that position, it doesn't make any difference when Senate Bill 20 went into effect or when the date of the accident was.
So again, then under your theory, every company in Ohio can cancel all the current policies and issue a new policy to the state of Tennessee. If they comply with the providing notice to the insurance policy canceled, providing new policy, yes, that would be the case. If there was an issue, there would be a period of time.
It says renewal.
Yes,
you got to have renewed something.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It says amendment at the top, no question about it. But the initial date, whether this is a 20-year-old policy, a 10-year-old policy, a 1-year-old policy, is not in the record. In order to achieve reversal, first, that properly before the trial court, properly in the record before the court, and they must prevail on two issues. One is the extraordinary incorporation issue, which may be borrowed from the Ross decision. And two, the renewal position, which has been discussed during this event, signed the other podium. The issue that a 6-month renewal on the record before this court is simply not adequate, does not qualify for statutory incorporation purpose. Initially, neither of these arguments was raised in the trial court. I believe that stable law in this case. So whatever law is pronounced, either today or in the future when a properly briefed case reaches the court, neither of the arguments, either the statutory incorporation argument nor the renewal, the 6-month renewal not qualifying for statutory incorporation, was raised in the trial court, and I believe that's fatal. The first, the issue that the court requested to be briefed, and the reason that you arrived at this case. We have briefed the notion of statutory incorporation, which Mr. Bannock brought up in the beginning. We've discussed the fact that for many purposes under the law, there is a clear distinction between tort law and contract law. Obviously, liability claims as a general matter arise out of tort law. Underinsured motorist claims obviously are pure contract claims. The contract law position has been raised in a variety of areas of the law. That has been upcoming terms, and you'll see that in our brief. Simply highlighted from our brief, we pointed out that in concurrence to the Floyd decision made by Justice Douglas, the distinction between contract and tort law was referenced on a number of occasions. In the Cranley decision and other decisions of this court, cited in a majority of people in Ross, again, the contract basis versus the tort basis of the underlying claim was referenced as a distinction. Most persons, I believe it's before this court, to determine, if you will, one way or the other, whether or not there's a to liability, policies of liability insurance. And if this court were to consider a policy, the issue also addressed by Justice Cook in her question to Mr. Bennett, the policy issue is different in the liability context than it is in the underinsured motorist context.
You're posing counsel suggests that we have to look at a hierarchy of values, so that the value of impairing a right of contract versus the victim's interest in this case. How do you, I suppose the argument is that the folks who bought this policy have an interest in enforcing the contract to the extent they protect themselves from liability that's uninsured. Okay, and then you have the other consideration about a victim who of a tort who says the law changed, I sure want to take advantage of that change.
Well, first, in this case, quite frankly, speaking of it, your second question first, victim of tort, and addressing it from a policy consideration, overwhelmingly, statutes as we move into the future are more beneficial to individuals. And the notion of question you ask whether we always have to record, whether we have to go back in time and incorporate statutes from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, will overwhelmingly be cruel to individuals because then it will play a side, perhaps part of the side as well. Overwhelmingly, the statutes on the books in the '90s are more consumer friendly than the statutes on the books in the '70s. In terms of the general notion, I think a contract right applies to the Snyders. The Snyders are not here before this court. The Hilliards are here. The underlying plaintiffs are here. The Hilliards are not parties to the contract of insurance. They're not certified beneficiaries to the contract of insurance. And in fact, from a policy point of view, had no way to have any expectation as to what kind of insurance would be had by somebody who ran into that automobile, or what the original issuing date of the policy would be. And in fact, logically, if the expectation of the Hilliards is really an issue here, the most logical law to apply in this liability insurance context would be the law at the time of the accident, because that's the only law that they could expect to be applied. They would have no knowledge of the insurance policy as issued it. Even if this court were to determine the statutory incorporation properly applicable in the liability insurance context, I think the key in this case, that this is simply not how to deal with the problem. And we briefed this issue, and the appellants would say, yes, we argued in the trial court, and the appellants have argued before this court, we argued in the trial court. The trial court was about constitutionality of Senate Bill 20. Integrally resolved by this court. That's not an issue on appeal. But what was argued in the trial court was that Senate Bill 20 arguably violated the retroactivity of laws provision of the Ohio Constitution. Thereafter, in the nature of revisionist history, appellants are arguing, oh, we really argued statutory incorporation in the trial court. It was included somewhere in the retroactive complication of laws argument. That argument is really not what the trial court arguments were all about. The trial court was about constitutionality and only constitutionality. In fact, the argument was first raised in the case of the Court of Appeals, the argument of statutory incorporation. And in the footnote, the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals, the 11th District indicated that appellant never made any arguments involving the renewal of the liability policy and or whether the Commonwealth was incorporated into the Hilliard policy. They only argue constitutionality in the trial court. If appellant would have argued this statutory incorporation argument in the trial court, they would have necessarily turned to the policy, which I just looked at for you on attaching to the counterfeiters. Oh, October 21st effective date, we have to get into this renewal argument. Self-evidently, the renewal argument was never broached in the trial court. In fact, it was never broached until the reply brief in this court. Not broached through trial court, not broached through the court of appeals, not broached through the public brief. This renewal argument was only broached when we pointed out in response, look at the policy, that's the counterclaim, 22nd, October 21, you must demonstrate to prevail that the renewal on October 21 doesn't qualify the transitory incorporation. Moreover, and I'm skipping, but allow me to address the question previously discussed. The renewal argument was presented in exactly the opposite fashion, both in the Court of Appeals and in Appellant's initial brief before this court. In the Court of Appeals, on page 12 of the Court of Appeals brief, in the caption section on that page, Appellant was more than happy to argue renewal is plenty good enough for incorporation. On page 15 of the brief in this court, Appellant was more than happy to argue renewal is plenty good enough, simply because the issue of renewal on the day after the effective date of Schedule 20 was apparently not noted until after we briefed in this court. As a matter of Ohio law, we believe that waiver of that argument is clearly required, and we briefed that thoroughly in the document report. On the subject of waiver, we point out that the two authorities listed by Appellant somehow trying to argue that we didn't really waive the argument, that an interim decision like the Ross decision can rekindle our right to raise something and tell us on Supreme Court level. Neither the Richard nor the, I believe it's pronounced, Junkie decision is applicable to this issue. The Richard opinion actually simply was a failure to object to jury discussion. It had nothing to do with the failure to raise a theory of recovery, a theory of outcome determinative theory of trial court. It certainly had nothing to do with an interim decision being viewed as avoiding the waiver time. Similarly, the junkie decision of this court simply had to do with the fact that contributory negligence is obvious to law. Interimly, this court, it was decided that comparative negligence was Ohio law. And that argument in the trial court is the same argument, so the argument is really raised. There was no issue before the junkie court that an interim decision should somehow avoid waiver of an argument not raised in the trial court. Finally, I want to stress the issue of renewal. What I think is the crux, as the Sutton pointed out, that in order to reverse Court of Appeals in the trial court, we must determine that the October 21, 1994 renewal was somehow did not qualify, even if we decide statutory incorporation is applicable to liability insurance policy. And on that issue,
similar situations and a variety of circumstances.
In a related case to this one, there are a number of Hilliard cases brought against a number of insurers. In Hilliard versus State Farm, the related case in the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals, the 6-month renewals were held applicable, not challenged, based on the 2-year statute, for the purpose of the incorporation of a prior rejection under insured motorist coverage. In this case, whatever we do with the 6-month renewal, if the policy is enforced at all, we should go back to the traditional criteria for determining whether or not a renewal qualifies as a new contract for statutory incorporation purposes.
So the other case you're arguing, the Hilliard case now that you're talking about, or whatever case it is, the carrier is arguing that the incorporation is there. I mean, the carrier is arguing it because they have a prior rejection under a renewal.
And in fact, the court so held.
Okay.
Understood.
So what's good for the insurance company ought to be good for the insured. I mean, we ought to say, here in this specific case, the policy that I've looked at attached to the counterclaim specifically says renewal.
Yes.
Okay. Now, to me, you know, I'd have to close my eyes to reality, not to say that renewal is not a word of art. That means something.
Yeah.
It means that we are reconstituting something that's already been.
Yes.
Okay. In this case, the date of the renewal was October 21, 1994. Had to renew something. Senate Bill 20 was one day before that. October 20. Well, we probably wouldn't have the problem if it was 2 days after. So it's now before it, one day. And the accident was after that. We've already determined that this is probably a contractual thing, not a tort thing. Now, having done that, how do we get around that there was a renewal and it renews something that was in existence?
It's clear.
Okay.
The issue is whether it's qualified.
Well, so therefore it was before October 20th, before Senate Bill 20.
Renewal the day what?
But the renewal renews something that was before that.
So the question then, the electoral question, is whether or not the renewal on the 21st satisfies the requirements established in Benson, the incorporation of statute on the book, on the date, on the effective date of the renewal.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Manning, you've used your time. It's maybe 30 seconds.
Show, Justice Pfeiffer's asking, I think, too, does that policy show at the back this October 21, 1994 renews October 21, 1993 policy? Is there an October 21, 1993 policy declaration in that policy? That date, is it used any place in the policy? That policy says that.
Yes, policy.
And that's the one attached. That's the one attached to the counterclaim.
Yes, it is.
That's all. Thank you.
So that is part of it.
Yes, it is.
Sure.
Yes, sir. I remember reading
that.
just going to join the all along from the beginning, the main issue in the case is in the application whether or not the boy that has claimed in this kind of story are applicable to the insurance policy. And we've raised a number of different arguments in support of the same issue. We did refer to that the constitutional provision regarding the terms of contact in the trial court. We didn't use the moniker incorporation argument. I think that as the court is aware, this is an area of particular thinking, and I don't know how often that particular label has been applied to particular arguments and when that started.
So your response is your objective is to start to finish. So the legal theory maybe of man has changed based on loss.
Based on loss, yes. Mostly based on loss. I think that was the one.
Thank you, Mr. Vanek. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinion.